So this is part two of the saga of Elazar ben Dordaya, or as he's called in the Gemara, Rebbe Elazar ben Dordaya, who was addicted to sexual desire, had frequented every zona, heard about a very exotic, foreign zona, lived in a city by the sea, traveled across seven rivers carrying a pack of gold to solicit her services. I spent the first year trying to trace the pathology and the toxicity of addiction, of escapism, of fantasy. Now he meets her. And he enters the room, and he's ready to commit the terrible avera. And somehow, during this interaction between the two, she lets forth some gas, what we would call a burp. It's not exactly a clean language, but... And somehow, he gets startled, obviously. And she then turns to him and says, just like that gas that came out of my body can never be retrieved, similarly, Elazar ben Dordaya can never do tshuva. Now, this Elazar ben Dordaya had heard probably countless musar shmuzes from his teachers, from his mentors, from his parents, from his friends. Nothing got through to him. He was so hypnotized and so stupefied by his addiction. Somehow, this zona in that short little comment got through to him. Now, part of it is, and I alluded to this in the previous year, in one of the classic musar strategies for facing the glitz and the beauty and the attraction, is to remind yourself that one day it will all be rima vitolea, it will all be ground to dust. Even if you don't take that morbid sense of death and dust and worms, but just to realize that very often the subjects of our physical attractions, they're like you and me, they're regular people, bodies like you and me, digestive systems like you and me. And if we just are able to climb out of the fantasy in which we create fantasy objects rather than real objects and real people. And this gas that emitted from this woman was a jolt, was a reminder of Elazar ben Dordaya. What are you making out of women? To a degree, it's not just morally sinful from a sexual standpoint. It's also objectifying other people and turning them into objects of desire rather than human beings. And this brought him down to earth, reminded him that this is a human body. This woman has a human body, and that human body conducts the process of digestion, and part of the process of digestion and part of the process of life is not always going to be pretty. There's ugliness associated with it, and it's an entire package, and you treat human beings as an entire package rather than profiling and objectifying and turning people into objects. But what I also think happened was not just that the gas came out of this person's body, as it comes out from all of our bodies inevitably, but she spoke to him. And he hadn't heard that voice before because he wasn't expecting it. It was, on the one hand, very real and reductive and existential. She didn't talk about the dangers of sin, the immorality of sin, the folly of sin. She didn't talk in high-minded terms. But she spoke very, very directly to Rebbe Elazar ben Dordaya. This gas is you. You are this gas. This gas cannot be retrieved. You cannot be retrieved. And I think sometimes when we deliver Musar, when we think about Musar, we speak Musar, we try to find Musar voices, it's hard to speak and to cut through and to talk to people's heart and to talk about them. I try very, very hard when I speak to personalize it. I'm trying to live it for myself, but also to personalize it. Very often I'll say, think of the person that represents this trait. Think of the last time you did. Think of the way you can change. It's uncomfortable to get into people's private world and private space and make things personal. It's always easier if they're one of the words I really try not to use. I don't think I ever use it is one. When one does. I just feel that the one depersonalizes it. And when you depersonalize moral guidance, again, it's very respectful and you're not invading anyone's private domain or private autonomy. But you're speaking in such generalized terms that it's hard to connect. People don't always connect it and ground it to their lives. And I think that's part of what got through to Elazar ben Dordaya. This is finally someone that was speaking not about morality, not about ethics, not about values, not about ideology, not about philosophy, about you. Your life has finished. Your life has ended. Your life right now is like this gas. It will dissipate, it will vanish, you will vanish. And look, there's a balance between where we speak to people, and it depends upon what they see in us and what our prior relationship is. And to speak to someone you don't know that way would be offensive, but I think we have to learn to speak in these terms and to use this type of language in ways that still allow room for respect and aren't manipulative and monochromatic and didactic. There's a difference between didacticism and patronizing and being able to speak to people directly and to cut through and speak in existential terms. So my deep apologies, evidently stopping and starting a recording in the middle, which is natural to Elul, isn't working out so well on my phone. I'll try to find some workarounds. But this is part two of part two. This is the second part of the second discussion of Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya. If you're coming in the middle, in the first part I described the pathology that led to the sin, the addiction, the escapism, the groupthink. In the second part I started to describe why this woman and the gas that emitted from her body, whether it was a digestive gas or other form, why it had such an impact on Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya, why it shook him up, why her statement, just like this gas, will dissipate and will never be retrieved, so too you won't have Olam Haba, why it was so traumatic and so jarring to Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya. And I spoke a few minutes ago on this recording, obviously it was yesterday in real time, I spoke how that she spoke to him directly. Sometimes we speak too highfalutin, and we speak in theory, and we speak about philosophy and morals and values, and one should do this, and if one does this, rather than speaking, and certainly as an educator, speaking to people, trying to cut through and speak to their hearts and speak to their identity and employ the word you, and of course in a way that isn't invasive and didactic and pedantic and manipulative, but is sincere and raw and doesn't expect translation of values into life, but tries to cut to the core of life. And she spoke to him that way. You, Elizabeth and Dordaya, are like the gas. She didn't speak about the vanity of man and the transience of human experience. She didn't give him a pasuk in Kohelas. She was very direct and said, you just saw some gas. That is you. You cannot be retrieved. I think the other thing that was so effective about this woman was it was unexpected. And as a rabbi, I struggle a lot with this because you hear yourself speak all day, as I'm speaking now, and you just fall into cliche talk and hackneyed lines, and it's almost as if you're in a fishbowl talking to yourself, hearing yourself, and you wonder if people are actually listening. And how do you make sure that your comments are not just formulaic and rehearsed and repetitive? And so I try very, very hard to avoid dead words and cliches and phrases that just are so overworn that they just take away from. Because if there's an expected, when the ideas are expected, you know exactly what's coming out. Part of what made Rav Amital so transformative to me is I had no idea what the next sentence would be. And I listened on the edge of my seat, and my head was constantly turning on a swivel as the ideas gyrated and rotated. And, okay, people like that are very hard to find. They're very rare. But she wasn't, had it been a Musar schmooze from a Rebbe or teacher or parent or an older person, her friend, Sarah Belezer ben Dordaya would have said, okay, here comes the expected moral chastisement and moral reprobation. But all of a sudden, somebody wasn't expecting to speak in moral terms. This was a Zona. And it wasn't just what she said, but that she had said it and he wasn't expecting her to say it. And again, when you speak, you don't want to say things that are unexpected just for effect, but to make sure that you're not just repeating yourself and beating a dead horse, as we say, and playing a broken record and hearing. There's a fascinating study. I quote the Talmidim often, which they took 50 people and asked them to be tappers, and 50 people asked them to be listeners. And they asked the tappers to tap their favorite song, like Mary Had a Little Lamb or something like that. And they asked the listeners to try to decode what song was being tapped. And they asked the tappers what percentage of the listeners will, or you think, are able to understand the song. And they said a very high amount. And they asked the listeners what percentage of you really understood the song. It was a much lower amount, like 10%. And the difference is because the tappers heard the music in their head. They knew the song they were tapping. So they assumed that people would be able to connect the tapping to the song. But the listeners weren't hearing the song. They were just hearing the tapping. And that's the communication gap that we always have to try to overcome in business and life and relationships and education. I know a Gemara. And I've seen that Gemara a dozen times, but my Talmidim haven't. If I just sing my own song in the Gemara that I know, I'll be a poor teacher. And it's true about moral instruction and moral guidance. And this is, how did this woman get through to Blaz Ben Dordai in a way that no one beforehand, of course, who knows how many years, they'd all reached futility. Anyway, so the story continues. He's shooken up by this whole encounter and by her reprimand. And he then turns to nature. And I have to be a little bit brief because we're starting a ceremony in Har Herzl for the soldiers who fell in the Yom Kippur War. So actually, I'm going to pause now, and I will give a third installment in a few moments when I'm finished with this, in about an hour, and I'll hope that they all get stitched together properly. Okay, this year, I'm trying to get finished, hasn't really been able to be recorded in a single sitting. It's been a very busy day. We're commemorating the Yom Kippur War. We're at the cemetery today, Sikha building. So I spoke already about the pathology and the road to Chet and Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya. Maybe a little bit loud because I'm literally getting ready for Shabbos, setting the table while I'm speaking. I spoke about Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya's addiction, his escapism, his desire for fantasy. I spoke about Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya's groupthink that if everyone was paying this woman that much money, she must be worth it. I spoke about Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya's cognitive dissonance. He traveled seven rivers and at no point did he question himself morally. And then I spoke a little bit about how this Zona shook him up in a way that others hadn't, because she spoke to him rather than in a highfalutin manner, and because she spoke in ways that weren't expected, that weren't formulaic, that weren't cliched. So anyway, he gets shaken up, and at that point he turns to the heavens and to the sky. I'll just be brief because it's really almost Shabbos here, and he says, please daven for me. And the heavens say, they quote a pasuk in Yeshaya, we can't really daven for you because we have to daven for ourselves. And he quotes a pasuk in Yeshaya that predicts apocalyptic ransacking of the heavens and the earth. And then he turns to the planets and say, daven for me. And they say, we can't really daven for you. We have to daven for ourselves. And they quote a pasuk in Yeshaya about the planets being subverted during the end of days. And then he turns to another Gemara in front of me, in Avodah Zarah Yud Zayin. But he basically turns to these larger than life parts of nature, suns and planets and stars and heavens and earth and oceans. And he asks them to do tshuva. And they all say, no, we're too busy. Now, I don't think they speak, these are not animate objects. But the Gemara maybe is remarking that they couldn't because they were so busy. I think two things are at hand. First of all, he thinks that tshuva is so hard, and especially someone like himself, so far from tshuva, that only these larger-than-human components can really help him. And he has to turn to planets, and he has to turn to heavens, and he has to turn to the sun and the moon, and he has to turn. He has a sense that tshuva is something which is larger than he can achieve, too much for him. And the second part that I think he's starting to assume is that tshuva is part of the natural order, which Rav Kook said it is, and he has to find a way for the natural order to provide a return for him. So he's turning to forces of nature, hoping that they'll facilitate his return. And of course, his mistake is twofold. First of all, tshuva is not something that you need to consult with larger-than-life forces. It is obviously a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but it's, as the Pasuk says, in Parashas Vayelech, b'ficha uvilvavcha la'asosa, kikar v'lecha davar miyod, b'ficha uvilvavcha la'asosa. According to many Rishonim, that's not talking about Tara, that's talking about Tshuva. So even though it seems so unattainable, it's something which HaKadosh Baruch Hu offers and makes available, and dir shuas Hashem b'him matzo, and you don't have to consult with planets, and you don't have to consult with heavens. And the second mistake he makes is that Shiva is not part of nature. And Rav Kook, of course, had a very Kabbalistic view, and don't have time, certainly in Erev Shabbos, to drill under the hood of what Rav Kook described. I think I gave a shiur on that a couple years ago, and it should be on Y Hutara if you're listening to this. But tshuva is, if anything, it's an antithesis of nature. That's why the Gemara says, the tshuva kadma li'olam alpayim shana. Because when HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, he set into motion various systems of physics and biology and chemistry and astronomy that govern the world, the rules by which our world operates. And that makes our world more predictable and more manageable. And tshuva is a subversion of all these rules. Tshuva allows us to go back in time and change the past and to alter our behavior and to confess and to be absolved of sin in ways that contradict any moral and political instinct that HaKadosh Baruch Hu vested within the human heart. So tshuva, by definition, had to be created before this world because it's not part of this world. And when we access tshuva, we're accessing something otherworldly, a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the answer is yes, it is Bashamayim. Maybe it's not Bashamayim in terms of how hard it is to achieve. That all it takes is sincerity and all it takes is hard work. But it is something which is not part of this world. In many ways, the pasuk is to be inverted. It is Bashamayim, but it can be achieved by human effort, b'ficha levavcha lasoso, and brought down to this earth. But it's not part of this earth. And Blessed Ben Dodai realizes that the planets and the suns and the moon, they have their role in history and the end of days, and there's a historical arc that's inevitable, and when Mashiach comes, there'll be certain supernatural events, such as the sacking of planets and the subversion of the natural order. But tshuva plays out in the human drama, in the human realm, not in the larger, inevitable, predetermined historical arc, which the Nevi'im spoke about, and the planets are involved in. It's like they're two different frequencies. The planets are saying, we're involved in the Nevuos and Yeshaya. We're involved in the end of days. We have to worry about our role in the end of days. You're not. You're a human being. You have agency. You have decision. Your fate isn't inevitable. You won't be attacked in the end of days like we will be. And you should take matters into your own hand right now and daven for tshuva, having nothing to do with us. You don't need these larger than human forces, and having nothing to do with the predetermined arc of history as prophesied in the Nevi'im. Just sit down and perform tshuva. And he does. And heroically and tragically, he's so heartbroken. And he says, Ein hadavar tali elabi, a very resonant statement. And he puts his head between his knees. And he cries till he dies of a broken heart. And Abbas Kol emerges and says, Elazar ben Dodaya is mezuman l'chayei olam haba. He's welcome to the next world. Not just as he has a place in the next world, he's welcome in the next world. And to me, this is the final scene of the story. And I tell the Talmidim all the time, all it takes, all tshuva takes, is one single authentic tear. That's all. It takes 40 days to allow that tear to surface. Because the tear is blocked by deceit and denial and confusion. And as Rav Lichtenstein called it, the terrible dam that we erect for ourselves, that we prevent any tears or emotion from emerging or developing. And we have to find some way to surface that one tear, that one authentic tear, one teardrop. Or even if we can't surface that teardrop, at least to know that it's developing in the dark, murmuring depths of our soul. And even if that tear doesn't make its way to our eyeballs and doesn't emerge, just to know that it welled up in our soul in that dark swamp of identity and subterranean thought and the dark recesses of who we are, to know that we broke, that we winced, that wince was real and authentic and jarring, and you know when it happens, and it's the most gratifying, in some ways, part of Yom Kippur, to know that you've reached the level of sincerity, that you're not just thinking, but you're emoting, and that you're emoting in ways that touch the depths of your soul. That's all tshuva is. And for Leza ben Dordaya, obviously it was so heartbreaking that it led to his death, which then led to his entry into the next world. So these are some of my quick thoughts about the end of the story. I apologize that it's a little bit brief, more brief than I would have wanted, but it's almost Shabbos here, and I'm working hard to get ready for Shabbos. The story of Elazar ben Dodaya, the story of addiction, the story of escapism, the story of fantasy, story of groupthink, the story of moral cognitive dissonance, the story of unexpected moral input, the story of speaking to people's heart, not above their heads, the story of agency rather than relying on others, the story of tshuva being a human-driven process, lo b'shamayim, yet being a process that is b'shamayim because it's a gift and it's not part of the natural world, it's not part of the prophecies, and the story of tears and heartache, and rachmana liba boy, especially during this time. Shabbat shalom.